You're listening to Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Giotakis. Walk down Wilshire Boulevard or 6th Street, or really any street in Koreatown, and you're bound to see some cyclists zipping by. Droves of bike riders on the streets of LA are nothing new, of course, but when they're carrying overstuffed backpacks, traveling directly to the unhoused and encampments, well, yeah, that sticks out.
You know, my mother used to say, always look for the helpers. Anybody who is coming into a place where there's a tragedy. Oh, baby, because if you look for the helpers, you'll know that there's hope.
Mike Pack is one of the founders of Bicycle Meals, a Koreatown-based mutual aid group. They've been serving K-Town's unhoused Meals on Wheels during the pandemic.
Our goal, our main goal, is really feeding the homeless every day. And we're almost there.
The need for help here is great. Last time there was an official homeless count, the number of people on the street nearly doubled between 2018 and 2019. And those numbers, well, they don't look like they've gone down. That's a lot of people on hard times. As the number of encampments grows and many people feel frustrated about how to solve the problem, lots of residents have been moved to extend a compassionate hand. KCRW's Angel Carreras tells us about Bicycle Meals. It's a group that makes a difference, one bicycle ride and brown bagged meal at a time.
The Bicycle Meals operation to feed the unhoused, it starts in the kitchen. About a dozen or so 20 to 30-somethings are gathered in a tiny kitchen in Emmanuel Presbyterian's basement on a Thursday evening. In front of a big, kind of blonde, Jesus mural, they're all in sync.
Do two people want to come start help with this little assembly line here?
Someone opens a brown paper bag, passes it to another person who puts in a water bottle and fruit. Another person puts in a sandwich. Wash, rinse, repeat. They make upwards of 80 of these to-go meals. And a lot of people here, by the way, are volunteers who joined up last year.
My job had recently switched to be from at home in K-Town where I live because of the pandemic, of course. Just perfect time in my life to dedicate more time to doing stuff that, you know, I want to do, which is helping the community.
That is Jacob Halpern, a graphic designer and activist in the area. He immediately rolled up his sleeves for this DIY operation, making dozens of meals just 2 weeks in.
Night before, day before, do the prep, you know, go to Ralph's, get the stuff, prep it up in our apartments. I have a studio apartment, takes up most of the room on the floor, just putting all the bags out and stuff.
And here's 32-year-old Alex Gilbertson, who moved to LA from Minnesota and joined Bicycle Meals a year ago. He was a chef back home, so being in a kitchen isn't new to him, and he delivers food for his job now, but it wasn't job familiarity that endeared him to this crew and this endeavor.
Moving here a year ago, I just felt more at home here in a city of 4 million than I ever did growing up in a small town in Minnesota of 4,000, and Bicycle Meals has showed me that tenfold, and I think that the relationships that we've built here with the people have been amazing because the foundation of your relationship is predicated upon the want to help out your unhoused neighbors on an afternoon that's either really hot or raining or just whatever it is. And so to have your relationships built off that has been phenomenal, especially during a pandemic.
And peeking his head in during meal prep is the head of this whirlwind of bike shorts, lunch meat, and protein bars, Mike Peck.
Do we take the trash out every night?
When he's not asking deeply existential questions such as this, he walks around in the church basement saying hi to everyone, helping out. And by the way, he's stoked to be in this church basement, despite it being, well, a basement, because this is their new base of operations. They're not making sandwiches in a studio apartment anymore.
You know, we used to do this just by ourselves in our apartment. So this opens the door for, you know, more food, being able to be prepped a lot quicker. And different activities we could do together and, like, really learn more about each other.
And when he's not learning more about his volunteers, Pack is everywhere in K-Town. A little bit about Pack. He's a fun-loving guy. He sports a WWE-inspired basketball tattoo, which is incredible. He sometimes shaves his head into mullets. People are just naturally drawn to his orbit. He brings people together to break bread at his burger joint, Love Hour. He cardios alongside friends and unfamiliar faces in his neighborhood running group, Koreatown Run Club. But there's one segment of Koreatown that he wasn't uniting or getting to meet as often as he'd like. That was the unhoused. He felt a duty to help them. He just wasn't sure how.
I would tell my friends all the time, I want to do something, but I don't know what it was. And they just really called me out and said, hey, you can always make time. Just start it next week.
So he prepped some meals in his apartment and threw up a prayer on social media.
That Monday, put it on Instagram. And that following Friday, we met in front of my house. And 20 people that I did not know from the neighborhood showed up and was ready to work.
The crew maintained a regular cast of volunteers throughout the pandemic, bumping up their initial one-day-a-week service to three. On a Friday morning, cyclists show up at Emmanuel Presbyterian Church off Wilshire in South Brando around 11 a.m.
Everybody good?
Absolutely.
Thanks, guys. We'll be back tomorrow.
They load up the meals into their backpacks. Some look like Atlas, holding the world. Almost comical, the body-to-pack ratio. They soon scatter into different directions to blanket as much of Koreatown as a dozen or so cyclists can. Here's an unhoused K-Town resident Bicycle Meals regularly serves, Salvador Tello. He details how he typically gets food around the mutual aid service days.
Nighttime, the food. Gotcha. When the restaurant and everybody close, drop the food nice, I go get it.
The brown bag lunches are a welcome break.
It's nice, talking nice, it's very happy, you know, nice person. Then give us everybody something, you know. Kind of water, chips, and cereals.
Gotcha.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Nearly a year in doing this now, some strain is starting to show. A lot of volunteers, for instance, are back to their respective offices as workplaces reopen.
We all have full-time jobs. And as things get back to normal with society, everyone goes back to work. It's going to be tough to do weekdays. So it's just figuring out and pivoting and seeing what our volunteers can do. Yeah, we're just rolling with the punches.
And the titular meals? Sometimes local businesses like K-Town's Open Market will contribute sandwiches, cookies, but Bicycle Meals is essentially self-financed. So when they're not getting help, they're paying for everything. And that's going to be hard to sustain.
For the most part, it's out of pocket. And I think talking with everyone and long-term wise, I don't think that's feasible and possible for us to do. So it's just partnering with other people and other organizations that are locally here and asking for help. And we have a lot of help here.
Additionally, PAC wants to team with other organizations to do more, like assistant job placement and housing for the people PAC's mutual aid group serves. Until that day comes, well, you're still going to see a Bicycle Meals cyclist zipping by, delivering food to the unhoused in the neighborhood every Friday, Saturday, and today, Monday. For KCRW, I'm Angel Carreras.
More movement of the two-wheeled variety now on Greater LA. Steve Chiatakis here. If you're a pro cycling fan, you probably know that the sport's greatest event, the Tour de France, started over the weekend. What you might not know, though, is that a women's race also took place called the La Course by Le Tour de France. And one of the riders taking part was pro cyclist Corinne Rivera from Orange County. Now, Corinne also found out recently that she'll be representing America in Tokyo next month at the Olympics. And Corinne Rivera joins us now for the latest installment of our series, talking with local athletes preparing to head to the Olympics. Hi, Corinne.
Hi, Steve. How's it going?
Doing all right. Congratulations, by the way, on your selection to Team USA in road racing. I know you've already done really well all over the world as a professional rider, but does this still feel like a big deal? You're going to the Olympics.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's it's a dream come true, honestly. Since I was a kid, I've watched all the Summer Olympic Games on the television, and it was even, you know, initially dreaming of being on the U.S. women's soccer team back when I used to play soccer when I was younger, and then obviously cycling kind of took over my life, and I get to go to Tokyo, so I'm really honored to represent the country, and ready to give it my best for a medal.
You've been doing La Course in France. Tell us a little bit about the course for your race in Japan. Is it going to be, even more challenging? I mean, what are the differences? Because the terrain is different, obviously, in both countries, right?
Yeah, it is. You know, Tokyo, we're going to do kind of like go part way up towards Mount Fuji. So it's the course will have a total of 2,400 meters of elevation, and that's over 7,000 feet for our Imperial listeners. So pretty big day, but it's not like a massive mountain climb. It's kind of a group of climbs in the first 60 kilometers that kind of undulate up towards that elevation, and then a little flat spot, and then a little descent that down into the Fuji Speedway. So definitely a difficult course. Also, the conditions will play into it with the weather and the humidity and the heat. But yeah, definitely not an easy race. But I wouldn't necessarily call it a climber's race either.
It's a team sport, though. You're going to be on the team, right, with other cyclists as well. So when you think about your competitors, other countries that are participating, who will be your toughest competitor, do you think?
Yeah, that's correct. It's definitely a big team sport. And the U.S. will be there with four in total, one of which will be myself. And yeah, the biggest competitors are the Dutchies. They've just proven over the last few years to be just extremely strong and can win in a lot of different scenarios. So going into this, a bit of an underdog, but yeah, we'll definitely give them a run for it and won't make it easy on them.
Well, you just mentioned, you know, there are four of you on Team USA, right? So for people who don't know or really don't follow cycling, explain the role that a team plays in a race. Like, how do you, is there, I'm going to play stupid here for a minute, which isn't hard for me. do you pass a baton? I mean, what happens with a four person team?
Yeah. So in road cycling, when you are your average watcher, you see one person cross the line and everyone knows who the winner is. But what most people don't know is that it takes a team and a few other riders to get that one person across the line first. So there is a team plan and there is strategy. And normally the person who wins, you kind of don't see them until towards the end of the race. And they're really conserving energy and your other teammates will kind of do some work for you, basically, keeping you out of the wind, chasing down a breakaway. Being in a breakaway even is a strategy so that you don't ever have to chase. So there's a lot of different ways that a teammate can help you, even getting water bottles for you. The name of the game is saving as much energy as you can until there's a certain point in the race where it kind of explodes. And that's kind of where the leader will shine and use their strength to make a go for the win.
Are you the leader in this team sport, Corinne?
Well, I think at the Olympics, it's pretty special because typically in a race, you have a team of six. So there's more options, more to play. But the Olympics is special in the sense that it's only a team of four. So you're a little bit more limited and you have to be a little more strategic on how you use the team. So I actually think we are going there with four leaders and kind of playing the game on when we can sort of unleash. And I think there's certain parts of the courses that are better suited to us where we can all kind of use our strengths to play our part in the race.
We've talked with a number of local women athletes going to the games about respect for women athletes compared with men. Softball, soccer, weightlifting, basketball, everyone has said the same thing, that their athletic work is not valued the same way as men's. I'm curious how you see it in pro cycling around the world.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit similar, but I think there's a lot of movement in getting some parity and equality as well. There's been a lot of changes recently in the last 2-3 years, I'd say, where there's a minimum salary now. The teams are a lot more professional. The races are becoming professional. So there is some movement and we're going in the right direction, but it's still much different from the men's racing.
Do you see that changing? Are people becoming more aware of women's cycling and understanding it to be as competitive and just as good as men's cycling?
Yeah, I believe so. And I think there's actually a really great opportunity to showcase that as we're getting more and more TV coverage year to year. And along with that, you know, our races are shorter than the men's. And, you know, normally the guys are racing like 5-6 hours, really long days. And to be frank, I don't think there's a lot of people who will sit there and watch the television for 5 or 6 hours watching the entire race. But women's racing is a bit shorter. I think our range of races is between 3 to 4 hours. So I think that definitely plays in our favor and makes our races more exciting, and then also makes it better on TV.
Entertaining, perhaps, but it's also, it can be dangerous too, right? You suffered a concussion last year, right?
Yeah, it's true. I was at a training camp in Austria and had a small crash on a bike path. Didn't see where there was a route that was kind of uplifting the tarmac under the shade. Didn't see it and just kind of ejected off my bike. And I'd say I'm normally a pretty good bike handler, but when you can't see that there's a massive bump in front of you, it really takes you by surprise. So it tossed me off my bike and was knocked out for a little bit. Surprisingly took really good care of myself the first few days and a couple weeks, took a bit of a break and reset, and came back really well, thankfully, and didn't have too many symptoms, to be honest. So got pretty lucky on that one.
You grew up in Orange County. What part of Orange County are you from?
So I was born in Garden Grove, California, and then when I was about 6 or so, I spent like five years in Cyprus, and then when I was about 6, our family moved to Tustin, California.
Okay, all right. So all across the Southland, right?
Mm-hmm.
What was it like? I mean, were you said you played a lot of soccer as a kid. What was it like as an athlete growing up in Southern California? I mean, did you feel like you had a lot of opportunities, especially in cycling?
Yeah, I think what's funny, Orange County has a pretty fair amount of bike lanes. And I think also growing up in Tustin, when I found the bike, there was actually quite a few bike lanes and bike routes and even group rides that have been going on in the area for decades, I think. So it was actually a pretty cycling-rich area, and I'd say fairly safe because of those bike lanes as well. I love the area for riding. I was really supportive. Found a lot of local group rides and teams that I had ridden for a long time in the past when I was starting out with cycling. So, yeah, I'd say it was a pretty healthy environment to grow up with in cycling.
Well, we're rooting you on, Corinne Rivera. Pro cyclist from Orange County. She'll be headed to Tokyo next month for the Olympics, and watching you on TV and again, rooting for you with the red, white, and blue. Corinne Rivera, thank you. Good luck to you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. Steve Chiatakis here. Now let's talk about some legal drama in the county of Orange. A state agency has a bone to pick with Anaheim. The city reached an agreement to sell Angels Stadium and its parking lots to a company affiliated with the team's owner, Artie Moreno, back in late 2019. But the California Department of Housing and Community Development says city officials may have violated state laws in that agreement. Not the first time Anaheim has been under fire for the stadium sale. Gustavo Arellano writes for the LA Times, and yes, he's here once again for KCRW's Orange County Line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
So, you've never had a lack of words for Artie Moreno. So, but let's get this out of the way. The state says that Anaheim may have violated surplus land laws. Before we get into the weeds, tell us a little more about what those laws really are.
So, these are laws that have just been put in place in the past couple of years. Even I wasn't familiar with these laws until my colleague Bill Shaken broke the story. Basically, any public entity that has that's selling what they call surplus land, they have to put it out there. They have to go to affordable housing builders and say, hey, if you're interested, we have this land, put in a bid for us before they can open up to anybody else. And the city still has the right to say yes or no to that particular, you know, to any prospective developer or any prospective buyer, but you have to go through that application process.
So the state then considers there to be a potential violation from the city of Anaheim in this regard.
Yeah, because what the state is saying is that the city of Anaheim didn't go through that process, just immediately negotiated with the company associated with Angels owner Artie Moreno and didn't bother to go with other, you know, with any affordable housing developers. What the city says in response is like, well, those laws weren't around when we started to do this exclusive negotiation with Artie Moreno, so therefore we can't be at fault. And then on top of that, what they say is that even if we were violating this law, well, the current contract that we have with Artie Moreno calls for 15% of all the housing that's going to be built on the Angel Stadium parking lot to be affordable housing. So therefore, Ali Ali Oxy free.
As I mentioned at the top, this isn't the first time that there have been concerns raised. Who else is unhappy with the negotiations?
Oh, gosh. People, basically community gadflies or watchdogs, but specifically Councilmember Jose Moreno, who from the start has been criticizing the deal. And this is a deal, by the way, that goes back years. You know, the current mayor, Harry Sid Hugh, before that, the Republican mayor, Tom Tate, openly said that Angels owner Artie Moreno just wanted a sweetheart deal, that there was one point where the city was proposing to lease the Angel Stadium land to Artie Moreno for $1 a year and then reap the benefits this way. So this is something that goes back years and years and years. And the big issue is the city of Anaheim getting all the money that they possibly can from this deal? So the deal was, the stadium was sold to Artie Moreno for, it was supposed to be $320 million that would go to Anaheim. Then that number got reduced to $150 million, with $170 million basically being in cost. Moreno said, well, I'll build this affordable housing, I'll build you guys a park and all that stuff. All of this follows a city commission review and analysis that said the city of Anaheim could get at least $500 million in the open market if they just knocked down the stadium and the parking lot and, you know, just sold it to the highest bidder.
I mean, it's by everything over there, right? You got the Honda Center, you got the Arctic, you got all of that in the neighborhood, right? So it is pretty valuable property. What's the city of Anaheim saying about all this?
Yeah, again, they're saying that we haven't violated anything, and even if we did violate this law where we're supposed to let affordable housing developers know about the sale of surplus land, Artie Moreno's already going to build 15%. In fact, the spokesperson for the city of Anaheim told the LA Times that, oh, this project's going to have the most affordable housing ever. Very Trumpian rhetoric, the most ever. It's like, okay, I get it. You're going to build affordable housing. At least that's what you say, but you still have to follow the law.
Well, superlatives aside, Gustavo, if it turns out that the sale is deemed as violating some state law, I mean, what does it mean for the future of Angel Stadium?
Well, this is where it gets tricky, because if this agency says that, yeah, you violated the law, or this department, then the city's got to pay a fine. And it could go to as much as $3 for every $10. Oh, God, what? How did Bill? It was kind of confusing, but basically it would cost the city tens of millions of dollars in fines, if not going up into the higher, like over $50 million. That at the end, then Anaheim, because Artie Moreno, he's still going to get this. If this goes through, the state is not saying they're going to rescind the deal. They're going to force a rescindment of the deal. They're just saying you're going to have to pay a fine on it. So the people are going to have to pay at the end if the city of Anaheim did mess up are going to be the taxpayers.
Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times with this week's KCRW Orange County. Boy, the dynamics between Moreno and the Angels and, of course, the city of Anaheim, always a lot of fodder there. Gustavo, thank you.
Gracias.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, off to Petula Clark's favorite place, and maybe yours too, downtown. has become destination and neighborhood in Los Angeles in recent years after spending decades as, well, the only 9-to-5 place to be. But the pandemic changed a lot and closed a lot. Is there a rebound on tap for DTLA? That is tomorrow. How about joining us online at kcrw.com/greaterLA, whether you're downtown, Santa Monica, El Monte, San Gabriel Valley, wherever you are, you can go online, check out any stories you may have missed, tell us how you're doing, what you're thinking. Most importantly, subscribe to the podcast, too. Get it delivered fresh to your feed, kcrw.com/greaterLA. Catherine Barnes, Jackie Sedley, Jenna Cagle, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Amy Toss, Sue Margulies, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordahl all put a lot of time and effort in this evening's show. Thank you for your time and attention. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Have a great night.